Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett. Coming up, we'll learn more about energy costs in Ohio. Jay Fox will also speak with experts about the dangers of knockoff weight loss drugs and the importance of protein in your diet. Plus, Doug Petcash from Face the State will have a look at state politics. First up on Columbus Perspective,
Ohio families could soon pay more for electricity as the federal government moves to extend the life of aging coal plants that were once slated for closure. The Citizens Utility Board of Ohio warns that keeping these facilities open will add unnecessary costs at a time when most households are already stretched to the brink by inflation. Tom Bullock, Executive Director of the Citizens Utility Board of Ohio, joins us now on Columbus Perspective to discuss the impact and what we can do to keep our costs within the realm of affordability. Welcome, Tom.
Good morning.
This sounds like a daunting task. What does the new federal order mean for Ohio utility companies?
Well, the federal order to date affects a Michigan plant, and there are many others in Ohio, or they're serving Ohio. They may be located in a neighboring state, but they provide power to Ohio. And if any or all or most of those are forced to operate beyond what the market would normally say is their useful life, it will add expense. And the reason for this is it's like going to the grocery store, and instead of you being able to shop for the cereal box that you want at the best price you want, you're forced instead, you have to buy this over here, and it's three times as expensive as the one you would want to buy.
I thought we were moving away from coal. When did that change?
Well, there's a mix of fuels on the grid, and coal is still here. Natural gas over the last 10 or 15 years has really increased in a significant way and taken over a lot of what they call baseload power generation. In your opening, you said aging coal plants. The important word is aging, because some of these facilities were built in the 1950s. We're talking about Dwight Eisenhower was president, and they're still operating. And doing so is very expensive, slow, hard to start and stop, hard to repair, hard to operate without a lot of high fixed costs. And newer facilities just have a lot of advantages because they're built to be more efficient and less expensive. And so that's the problem. Now, some of these old coal facilities are a little bit like an old aircraft carrier. The U.S. Navy likes to keep them for decades and decades and decades, and then they'll retrofit them and keep them some more decades. And that is what we're talking about with these coal plants. But at some point, it becomes too expensive, and the owners of the coal plants themselves say, we're done, we're losing too much money. That's what happened. But the White House told a Michigan company, you cannot close this plant that you are losing money on. You must operate it. And then the question that follows is, okay, who pays? And the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission said everybody in that grid pays. Now, that to me sounds crazy and backwards and unnecessary. So if we start to face this in Ohio's grid, we're going to get another layer of inflation on top of the inflation we're already paying for right now due to data center and artificial intelligence speculation and expansion.
So
it's like having multiple snows, multiple blizzards stacking up on top of your monthly bill.
It just sounds like a lot of hands in my pocket. What steps have we taken to promote the affordable, reliable energy that we need here in Ohio?
Well, many steps, as a matter of fact. So our regional grid is called PJM. They've got a market already. It's called the wholesale power market, and they've got an auction system which says, okay, we need this much power at this time period. Everybody put out your bids, and the market will choose the best price. And there's more than 1,000 power plants in that 13-state region that supply that market. And what the federal policy, the White House is contemplating, is making the most expensive 50 or 100 continue to operate. So you'd see how all that would do is can drive up the cost. Now, the other part of the answer to your question is the state of Ohio deserves some credit. This past June of this year, the state passed a energy law that renewed its commitment to market competition, technology neutrality. So it didn't say we want coal or we want natural gas or we want solar or we want any one thing. It said we'll let the technology people and the private business try to build a better mousetrap and do the best service to the grid at the best price. That, I think, is the right way to go. Now, the state of Ohio took that step. We have some influence because energy is kind of a layer cake of different shared responsibility. Much of it is the state. Some of it's this regional grid of 13 states called PJM, and some of it's the federal government. All those things influence the net price we pay.
Now, where does nuclear power fit into this equation with, you know, plants like Davis-Besse? And I don't know if this is a rumor or if there's any fact to it, but I heard they were actually having discussions about making Three Mile Island operational again.
Yes, I've heard that too, and that's because of data centers and artificial intelligence. They are expensive warehouses full of expensive computers, but that's just expensive junk unless you have electrons to power all of it and make it go. Those companies are kind of in an arms race with one another to build out and get market share. So they really want to have power, and sometimes it seems it's almost at any price. So they're willing to pay a premium or a super premium as long as they've got enough of it and it's reliable. So that's why you hear some of the really big companies, not even Fortune 100, it's probably Fortune 10 companies like Amazon, Microsoft, Facebook or Meta, you know, those big players are talking about those kinds of deals. Nuclear, though, to answer your question, is in the same mix as we were describing before. It can bid into the market at the price that it can produce, and then the power that it makes will be bought or not bought on some days and some weeks and some months, depending on what the market price is. And the price fluctuates seasonally. Sometimes there's COVID events that drop the price, and sometimes there's an economic boom that might raise the price because everybody's running factories. So this stuff fluctuates a bit. But in a technology-neutral, market-driven market, the Davis-Besse plant and others can compete. And I actually think they're probably in a stronger position today than several years ago because the price of electricity is going up. Now, is that a good thing? Not for consumers. On the other hand, what can consumers do to protect ourselves? We can insulate, air seal, use efficient lights, use efficient appliances. There's a lot of off-the-shelf steps we can take to protect ourselves. Utilities even have time of use rates. If you look it up and sign up, you can get a discount at midnight. You might pay more during the prime times, but you could, depending on your household needs, shift your dryer, your clothes dryer, or your dishwasher to midnight and get less expensive use of your household needs. So there's a bunch of options like that on the personal level. On the state and regional level, though, this conversation we're having about basically having the government come in and force the market to not be a market, but instead to pick one fuel source in aging, very old, expensive plants that there's just no way to operate in a low-cost manner.
Now,
you know, to me, that's saying the market loser is being forced to be used. That's going to make losers out of all consumers.
So in terms of federal policy, is there any chance for bipartisan agreement, or is it literally the thems versus the theys?
Well, I would ask you to check your crystal ball on that you got issued when you became a reporter, and tell me. I think it's possible that businesses and industries will say, "Hey, wait a minute, there's some economic damage that results here," and essentially a lobbyist is getting involved with the White House and asking for a special favor. That is the opposite of free market. That's the opposite of everything we know about the better product displaces an old product or forces the old product to reinvent itself and compete with the new thing. That's how business and products get better and how prices come down. Why are we meddling with that tried and true American formula? Well, we are because of politics and lobbyists. So what that would basically do is it's one industry using special political favors to pick the pocket of other industries and all of us regular consumers, Bob and Betty Buckeyes. That doesn't make any sense. I'm cautiously optimistic that we might hear some business leaders say, hey, we don't need more inflationary upward pressure on electricity prices, which are already going up for a bunch of other different reasons.
Well, Tom, to your point, Bob and Betty Buckeye do not want to know how the watch works. They just want to know what time it is. So do they have to turn their thermostat down to 65, get out an extra blanket and put on a sweatshirt? Or are we going to have a livable winter?
If they did, my parents would be proud of them. That's how we did it as kids.
Yep.
But I think, go back to what I said before. Like, often air sealing, get out the caulking gun. Now, that's a little bit of a chore, but it actually can make a big difference. It's not all that expensive or that much work. But in terms of... and then maybe in a five-year view, if you get a more efficient appliance, the next time you're replacing something, spend a little bit more, get a more efficient appliance, and it'll pay itself off, and then some. You'll be paying less over time. I do think with prices higher, Bob and Betty Buckeye and me and you may spend more time thinking about these things, because when prices are higher, we feel it in our pocketbook.
Oh, so, for sure. So for the listeners that want to do this deep dive, what's the best website to send them to? Because this was a lot to digest.
The Public Utilities Commission of Ohio and the Ohio Consumers Council has some resources. So do we. Citizens Utility Board of Ohio, it's called www.cuboh.org, has some resources about how to, as a consumer, lower your costs. And also, when you're shopping for your energy or natural gas supplier, how to evaluate what is a good deal, what is going to get you with hidden fees and all those kinds of consumer risks. So there are resources out there. The state does a pretty good job. I do think you have to 15 minutes to study it, but it's not as bad as doing your taxes.
Absolutely. We want to thank Tom Bullock from the Citizens Utility Board of Ohio for joining us. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's Jay Fox.
Obesity is a disease that can impact your overall health and also your quality of life and lead to serious medical conditions. Here in Central Ohio, almost 38% of all adults are obese. Doctors have been prescribing weight loss drugs like GLP-1s to help tackle the obesity epidemic. Those drugs can be very costly, and sometimes limited insurance coverage forces many patients toward unsafe alternatives. Joining us now is Dr. Angela Fitch. She's the past president of the Obesity Medicine Association, and she's here to talk to us about the concerns with these unsafe alternatives. Welcome to Columbus Perspective.
Thank you for having me, Jay.
It's our pleasure. So, Dr. Fitch, what are the biggest risks that a patient would face when they use an unapproved compounded GLP-1?
Well, really, Jay, compounded GLP-1 medications are not FDA approved. They're not the same as the FDA approved medications, despite what a lot of things say on the advertisements, which means patients are exposed to real and preventable safety risks. Large-scale compounders are producing knockoff, untested, unproven drugs. They often add unnecessary ingredients like B12 or falsely claim that they're personalized for individual patients when really, patients can't always be sure of what they're getting because it's not regulated the same way that our drugs are regulated that are FDA approved.
Why is insurance coverage such a critical factor in folks having access to obesity treatment?
Well, Dave, this is the most important thing, I think, is that obesity is the most common chronic disease, as you mentioned, even with Ohioans, the data earlier that Ohioans struggle in America. But outdated insurance coverage policies means that too many people can't afford FDA-approved treatments because they have an exclusion on their insurance, and their employer hasn't chosen potentially to add that because of the cost, right, of these medications. And so now that the cost is coming down, and now that as of last week even, you know, it is allowed now for Medicare to cover these treatment options, and so now that Medicare can cover it and the cost is coming down, our hope is that more and more insurances will cover it as a standard benefit for all Americans so that we don't have this inequality that we're seeing today, and we don't have patients needing to go to online places to get questionable products.
There's a third entity in the mix. So, for example, your prescriber, your provider, prescribes you with a prescription for one of these FDA-approved products. Your insurance company covers the product, but the pharmacy benefit manager who deals with the pharmacy that will supply that product sometimes has the right to say no. How does that work?
Well, it's really a little bit more complicated than that. And that's what we try to advocate for, too, is to uncover some of the, this process is not very transparent to all of us as Americans. And I think a lot of what we're talking about over the past year or so, even with coverage of obesity, has been able to make things a bit more transparent. And so, again, because obesity isn't a standard benefit, it has to be offered by your insurance, which if you're getting on the marketplace, might typically has an exclusion for obesity because Medicare didn't cover it. So Medicare doesn't cover it, so other insurances don't cover it, despite the fact that it's a chronic disease. And we've known that since 2013, when the American Medical Association said obesity is truly a chronic disease. It's not any one patient's fault, and it's not just about willpower.
So for the listener that's hearing this, what can they do if they are denied by insurance and can't afford the out-of-pocket expense? What choices do they have?
Well, there are older medications for obesity treatment that are more affordable than the GLP-1 medication, so that's an option. And so we do, encourage patients to, at a baseline, work with a clinician that they can trust, someone that's going to care for you for the long term, not a short-term transactional relationship in order to get access to a medication. That's typically not how we deliver medication, especially for chronic conditions or chronic diseases. So working with someone, my clinic is called KnownWell. We see patients across the country in 50 states virtually and in 6 states in in-person clinics. And you can find a reputable clinic, near you or clinician near you, or talk to your primary care clinician, about what treatment options do you have that may be affordable for you until these become much more affordable over time, which they will. That's the exciting piece, is that there are going to be new oral formulations of these medications coming out next year, hopefully pending FDA approval of these drugs, and those will be much more affordable for patients, more around, the $150 price point instead of a higher sort of $499 price point where things live kind of now from a cash standpoint.
So from a regulatory standpoint, what can our state legislators and Congress do to make patients safer and protect them against these knockoff drugs, which I have to be honest with you, when you see those ads, whether they're on broadcast or on social media, they look like the real thing.
Well, that's the problem we've had as clinicians advocating for this to stop, because we really feel like, because obesity has not been a well-covered disease, you have a marginalized, undertreated group of people that feel as though their disease is their fault, and it's not their fault. And so when you have that, and then you have people, making money off of this type of un-FDA-approved versions, it really is a travesty. I have said long ago that this is the largest uncontrolled, unconsented human experiment of our time, because we are in fact, you know, experimenting with humans without their consent, because we're giving them what would be equivalent to an experimental drug by giving them a compound that might be mixed with B12 or something else in there, or not even the same compound as what they're getting, you know, when they get the FDA branded version. So we really need more regulation to stop this predatory practice that we see, and get patients, and then have the other regulatory piece of it, which is to have insurance coverage for the FDA approved versions, so patients don't have to seek out that care in the fashion that they're doing right now.
And speaking of those patients, doctor, what can the patient do to make sure that they know what they're taking is safe and approved?
Well, the only thing we know is safe and approved are those things that are approved by the FDA. So you should be getting that, you know, either from your local pharmacy or getting that from one of the mail order companies that the pharmaceutical companies have set up. We saw last week with the potential of Trump RX in order to, again, facilitate that connection to FDA approved versions so that patients can be protect themselves, right, from this practice. And I think, again, talking to your doctor about it and talking to your primary care about it and finding a practice that's going to help you for the health of it and not for the weight of it, right? This is more than a number on the scale. We're doing this to improve our health and well-being across our lifetime.
Now, for those who have listened to this interview this morning, we talked about transparency, but sometimes transparency also means the subject is beyond our comprehension. What is the best website that we can send listeners to give them a layman's understanding of what we've just talked about?
Yes, it's very important. And the Obesity Action Coalition is the patient advocacy arm for people with living with obesity, has been in existence for many years. And that is www.obesityaction.org. You can even find on there, there's a find a clinician, a searchable place to go to find someone who specializes in obesity care locally in your area. And it's a very good website with lots of relevant information for patients around this topic, as well as other topics related to obesity, such as surgery, lifestyle interventions, stigma and bias, if patients are experiencing that in the workplace, for example. Lots of good information on that website.
Well, we want to thank you, Dr. Angela Fitch, for joining us this morning. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Jay Fox.
Protein is having its moment. According to the CDC, protein now makes up more than 16% of total calories in the average American diet, reflecting a growing interest in meals that keep people both fuller and more energized. Dietitians say this shift illustrates how consumers are rethinking balanced eating and also looking for smarter ways to build nutritious meals. Registered dietitian Steph Grosso joins us now on Columbus Perspective to talk about the role protein plays in our diet. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
That's my pleasure. Why is protein such a major focus in nutrition right now?
Yes, protein is trending right now, and I am loving it. I recommend it with every meal to all my clients, and there's a reason for that. One, it helps stabilize your blood sugar, and it gives you that steady energy levels throughout the day, so you don't have that mid-afternoon crash. And two, it keeps you feeling full longer, so you're not really having those late-night binges. But most importantly, protein builds and repairs almost every cell in your body, including your muscle, your skin, your hormones, and your enzymes. So I'm loving this trend because I'm really noticing a lot of people focusing on getting their protein from real whole foods rather than just relying on supplements and protein powders. And so I'm loving what I'm seeing as a dietitian because we've been preaching this for a very long time.
You know, what's interesting is that protein can appear in places that most people don't think it appears. It's not just at the meat counter at, you know, the local grocery store. Give us some examples of what constitutes protein, the diversity of it.
Yeah, so you can get protein from, of course, animal sources, but also plant sources like your beans, tofu. Beans is also having a really big moment, which I'm very happy about. But also, you know, if you're always on the go, traveling, you can get convenient sources of protein as well. I'm a huge fan of Subway's Fresh Fit menu because they offer four sandwiches that are all over 20 grams of protein, which is huge because that's something that's very hard to find nowadays, especially when you're always on the go. So I'm very thankful for that menu because it makes it a lot easier to meet your protein needs.
So when we talk about building a meal that is protein-based, what is an example? I mean, do we have to give up the bread, or do we just need enough protein to balance the carbohydrates?
Yeah, so my motto as a dietitian is all about adding, not restricting. So I always ask, what can I add to my diet to make it more balanced? So what kind of protein can I add to amp it up? And I love bread, so please do not restrict your bread. And I shoot for about 20 to 30 grams of protein as well. So there's ways you can add little protein toppings, whether it's hemp seeds, you know, beans, like I said before. And of course, when you're on the go, you know, just as I said, with like Subway's Fresh Fit menu, there's different ways you can add into your diet.
You know, I'm a huge fan of red meat, but the price of beef has gone through the roof this year. And when I make chili now, I am finding myself looking at alternative sources of protein. What are some other choices besides red meat that we can look for either in chili, in a meal, or in a sandwich?
Oh, beans. Not only you're getting all this protein from beans, but you're getting fiber. I believe one cup of beans has about 8 grams of fiber, and Americans are not getting enough fiber. 95% of Americans are not meeting their needs, which is about 28 to 35 grams of fiber per day, and we're just not hitting that. So beans is a great alternative protein because you're getting about 10 grams of protein, and you're also getting 8 grams of fiber. So you're getting best of both worlds. And I always recommend it to all my clients because it's so versatile. You can put it in your chili, like you were saying. You can toss it in a salad. You can make a dip out of it.
They say that the dip sounds really good right now. They say that the body changes every 7 years, and obviously based on age, gender, perhaps even ethnicity, and also the activities that the individual engages in, how does that change the need for protein? Do some people need more than others?
Yeah, so first, if you're very active, you know, whether it's going to the gym or you're walking, if your work requires a lot of movement, that's going to require more protein because you want to replenish your muscle mass. Two, as you age, you really want to increase your protein as well because as you age, you start to lose your muscle mass. So we want to make sure we maintain that. And of course, men tend to have higher protein needs because their body's built larger than women. But mostly, the more active you are, the more protein you need.
I usually split my time between Subway and Jersey Mike's when I try to build a sandwich. When you talk about this protein-focused, I think you called it the healthy options menu. What are they calling it these days? They've done it once before.
It's Subway's Fresh Fit menu.
Okay, that's right, the Fresh Fit menu. Is it just double the protein, or have they remove some things that are in other sandwiches that are not protein-based?
So what I love about this menu is, one, like you said, yes, they increase their protein. So all of the sandwiches start at 20 grams of protein. And, of course, you can dial it up. The grilled chicken and avocado and the seasoned steak and avocado has 35 grams of protein, which is amazing. But not only that, a sandwich contains one full serving of veggies, which is amazing to see because that's so hard to find nowadays when you're out on the go. So I love that. And every sandwich is served on a hearty multigrain bread. So you're getting that carbs, or you're getting your energy from that carb. So it's a nice balanced sandwich that it's, yeah, you really don't see when you're on the go. So I'm very happy that Subway reintroduced this menu.
Now, isn't avocado a source of fat?
Yes, that's why I love the chicken and avocado and the grilled steak avocado, because that really balances the whole meal, because the avocado has healthy fats. And that also helps with, you know, feeling full longer. It helps with your hormones. So highly recommend if you haven't had that yet.
There you go. Now, for people who want to learn about the macro subject, not just the menu items at Subway.
The CDC website will have all that information. You know, I like to look at the Academy of Nutrition Dietetics. That's usually my go-to source.
All right. We want to thank dietitian Steph Grosso for joining us. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Now, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV, here's Doug Petcash from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV.
The Maria Tiberi Foundation is now moving into its 13th year working on its mission to prevent teen driving deaths. Maria Tiberi died in a distracted driving car crash in 2013. She was a senior at Ohio State University majoring in graphic design. Now the foundation in her name is working to end distracted driving and save lives. Our Dom Tiberi and his wife Terry started the foundation about a year after Maria's passing. It raises money to donate driving simulators, more than 200 so far. Simulators are now in 4 schools in Central Ohio. The foundation also sponsors safe driving days in the summer for young drivers to practice on a real outdoor course. I talked with Dom about the mission of the Maria Tiberi Foundation. You and your wife Terry started the foundation about a year after the passing of Maria. Why was it important to you to get something positive going so quickly?
Well, there's nothing we could do to bring our daughter back. And, you know, we were in a situation where we had lost our child. We were in disbelief. It is a parent's worst nightmare. And, you know, I had a conversation with my wife and I said, listen, if I go back on television, because there was a part of me that said maybe I won't do television anymore, because I was just that broken up and she was. And I said, if I go back on, we're going to have to embrace this. And I tell people that I learned to love the pain, and we've turned what is the biggest tragedy that any parent can go through into a mission. And our mission is to keep other families from going through this. And every time we see another child lost, it just breaks my heart, and I relive all that, because my goal is to end this madness. To me, the biggest frustration is that the leading killer in the United States, the leading killer in Ohio of children age 8 to 24 is car crashes. And amongst all age groups, it's the third leading killer, with cancer being one, heart disease being one, cancer two, and car crashes three. And, you know, I ask, what's more preventable? And so this is why we've done it. And there's nothing we can do. I mean, believe me, I've thought for years, how can I bring Maria back? What can I do to bring her back? And there's nothing you can do. And for a person like me, who's type A personality, who my thing is, you go fix it.
Yeah.
You can't fix death. There's no do-overs from death.
You've done simulators. You've got them in 4 schools now. You have driving courses over the summer. Does it occur to you maybe like how many lives you have saved, or
you know, people say to me, Doug, and they say, well, if you saved one, and I immediately say, I don't want to save one. I want to save them all.
Yeah.
And I don't know. And I hope we've had an impact. You know, between the simulators through the foundation, we have 4 schools up and running. We initially put simulators around the state of Ohio with police departments. Then through my 10 TV family, we started Maria's Message. I've been to 170 high schools.
Wow.
I've spoken to businesses. I've spoken to colleges. And we provide free defensive driving classes. And, you know, I've been involved. The station's allowed me to be involved with the political side of this. And, you know, I helped lobby to get a hands-free law in Ohio. And I applaud the governor for that. We were able to get the driver's edge age pushed back to 21. Anyone 21 and under now has to take driver's
edge. How important do you think that is?
That is huge, because if you look at the statistics, a lot of the crashes that you are seeing are caused by 17, 18, and 19-year-olds. The stats don't lie. And, you know, the thing about stats that I tell people is every statistic has a name, has a face, and has a family that's missing them. And so, to me, that is why this was so important. We've got, you know, driving a car is not a right. And we need to remember it's a privilege. Mm-hmm. And that you're sharing the road with everybody. And your actions can not only affect you, but can affect other people. And so I think it's important that we do it. And the governor gets it. I applaud Governor DeWine. He's in this club that no one wants to be in. He lost his daughter. John Kasich lost both of his parents in a car crash. And so the leadership of Ohio knows firsthand the pain that you can have happen to some loved one in an automobile. And so we need to do a better job of educating our children. We've got to do a better job. And I'm hopeful that we're going to be able to get driver's ed back in the high schools. I know there was an attempt to do it, and it did not make it out.
It has to start with a conversation, right?
But yeah. It needs to happen. It needs to happen. You know, we identified putting the simulators in at the career centers. These are our people that are going to be working. This is our workforce, and these kids got to be able to drive, and we got to make it affordable for them. But we need to figure all this out, because, you know, I pray for the day that we have autonomous highways. You know, we have a road from Dublin to Marysville where that is happening. That's when some of this will hopefully get a lot better. But we all need to drive defensively, not distracted.
And finally, Dom, just how can people help the cause if they would like to?
Just have a conversation with your child. Let them know that they're loved, that they're important. And you, as parents, are the best judge of your child's driving ability. And I understand it can be a burden when they're in high school and you've got to take them to all these things. But the biggest thing you can do is monitor your child. I tell parents, you pay for the phones, you pay for the cars, you pay for the car insurance. You know, it's a privilege for your child. You can take those things away if they're not going to do what you tell them. Because at the end of the day, I'd rather have your kid a little mad at you than what we had to go through.
For more information, you can go to MariaTiberiFoundation.org. We'll be right back.
When you're high, you feel different. You think different, you talk different, you draw different, you listen to music different, but you probably knew that. Problem is, you also drive different, and not in a good way. That's why driving high is illegal everywhere. So if you're high, just don't drive. Make a plan to get a sober ride. Because if you feel different, you drive different. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Now to a major new development in the Columbus arts scene. The Columbus Association for the Performing Arts, or CAPA, is gearing up for a multi-million dollar renovation of a former church in the downtown. 10TV's Jay Plyburn gives us a tour and a look at the plans.
This historic building in downtown Columbus was once filled with hymns and hallelujahs.
We're in the former Central Presbyterian Church.
Built in 1859, it's one of the longest standing structures in all of downtown.
And this is the oldest photo we have of this church.
But after more than a decade of silence,
2011 was the last service.
The Columbus Association for the Performing Arts is breathing new life into the space.
We want to reopen it as a music venue.
Bringing in a multitude of different sounds while carefully preserving this unique piece of history. CAPA is raising money to transform the former church into a community event space.
We're about $10 million towards our $14 million goal.
Unlike CAPA's other theaters, this one will have a stage that moves.
So we're calling it a performance platform. It can be in the middle of the room. It can be at the far end. So if someone wants to do a really intimate show with the platform in the middle, we can build a small platform in the middle and keep the rest of the floor open.
Theater in the round, you might
call it. Theater in the round, that's exactly right.
How many can you put in that main space?
For a standing room concert, 690.
Where does that compare to the other? I mean, obviously, it's falling short of the Ohio Theater in some places, but it's not the smallest of the venues, is it?
No, it won't be the smallest. It fits in a gap that where we have a deficit.
The build-out involves a new HVAC system, even a rooftop bar.
It reshapes the model of what it means to be in a Kappa venue.
And many facets of the former church are staying in place, like the iconic stained glass window.
Built here in Columbus by the Von Grichten Glass Studio.
The chandeliers.
We're going to put some LEDs in them.
And parts of the original pipe organ.
Our intention is to make them scenery.
Not to mention the building itself.
Is it safe to say that this project is saving this structure?
Absolutely, yeah. A developer wanted the property. Obviously, it's a marquee piece of land downtown. That did not sit right with the congregation, and they came to Kappa and asked us to develop a reuse plan and purchase the church from them.
If all goes well, by fall of 2027, the same space that once lifted voices and worship will once again be filled with music, just a different kind.
Kappa has a great history of rehabilitating historic buildings. This is part of our mission, and it's our way to give back to the city.
Kappa hopes to hold opening night in the fall of 2027. Once it finally opens, this will be Kappa's sixth historic space, all of them in downtown Columbus.
Again, that's courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10TV. From the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10TV. This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan, heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS FM 97.1 The Fan and on 1460 AM, The Fan 2.